Not Just a Game podcast with your host, Dr. Catherine Flick, Senior Lecturer in Computing and Social Responsibility at De Montfort University in Leicester. Hello, and welcome to the Not Just a Game podcast. This week, I've got a special interview for you, and it's in the topic of political games. Unfortunately, this podcast has become a little bit of an occasional podcast instead of the fortnightly one, but I assure you that I'm going to still continue to do this, if occasionally, and that's why I'm very excited about this episode. So we're talking about political games this time, and I have David Stark, who is a game developer that I'm interviewing, who is very interested in responding to the events of 2016. And more recently, President Trump's executive order on incoming Muslims from various countries. So welcome to the podcast and enjoy this week's episode. Okay, so David Stark, or Zarkonnen, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and what it is that you've done recently and what you're actually up to?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a indie game developer from Zurich, which means I make game pretty much by myself for fun and profit. The main project I work on is actually a kind of PC strategy game called Airships Conquer the Skies, but I also do quite a lot of prototypes and side projects and stuff like that to keep myself sane, if nothing else.
Excellent. So you've made a game called Martian Immigration Nightmare. What actually inspired you to make this game?
So the kind of cause of it was a series of tweets by Elon Musk. So, of course, what happened a little while ago was this anti-immigration order by Donald Trump, where he just sort of stopped huge numbers of people from being able to enter the United States just on the basis of their nationality, even if they had visas, even if they had green cards, they were just being rejected. There were reports of people having their green cards taken away from them, of having their visas, thousands of people having their visas cancelled. And the whole thing was just sort of this humanitarian catastrophe. And Elon Musk, who is this, you know, kind of famous, fairly popular kind of technologist, billionaire type person, has been quite critical of Trump, but he's found himself on this tech advisory council that Trump set up. And so his comment on this when it happened was, and I'm just looking at the tweets now, so I don't misrepresent him. He said, please read the immigration order and let me know specific amendments. I will seek advisory council consensus and present to president. So he was sort of saying, well, you know, I can sort of try and convince Trump of maybe making it a bit less bad. Fair enough.
It sort of sounds like he was trying to work from the inside a little bit in some ways, doesn't he? I mean, there was that argument that, yeah, I mean, so there's this side that says sort of that he should stand up and just completely boycott any working with the president in any sort of way. But then there's, of course, the other side that says, but actually maybe if he's on the inside, he can actually do some, I don't know, like manipulation or, you know, kind of try to present Trump with some sort of, I mean, I'm not quite sure how he'd do that because it sounds like Trump's a bit of a crazy person, but I mean, what do you think that was what he was trying to do? Or?
Yeah, I think that's really the core question. The thing that he then later said was that he quoted someone else saying, after reading the language of the order, it looks far less bad than portrayed by the left. And he said, well, you know, you should read the source material rather than reading other people's opinions. And actually, that was really the bit that made me angry because it was really missing the point. It doesn't matter what the order says. It matters how it's interpreted, how it's executed. Yep. And it was being used as a excuse by people in like the Department of Homeland Security to do the things that they probably wanted to do anyway and to start doing really awful things. Yeah, and so I was, you know, I kind of maybe think of Musk as being a fairly sensible person, and so I was really quite disappointed in what just looked like him making excuses for the Trump administration like that.
Yeah, because I think, I mean, it seemed to me, I mean, Musk is well known for his innovative and progressive kind of agenda. He wants to, you know, deal with, like, he's looking very much at renewable energies. He's looking at kind of pushing human civilization beyond Earth and things like that as well, isn't he? So, I mean, it's like you said, I think the technology, I mean, I've been in the tech community and the tech industry for a very long time now, 20 years or so at least, and I think people, I mean, the tech people generally tend to think of themselves as kind of progressive and tend to, you know, like to kind of support interesting, you know, envelope pushing agendas in terms of, especially, I mean, especially things that also just happen, you know, or not just necessarily just happen, but things that also tend to promote things like sustainability or, you know, solutions to environmental or social problems as well. And so I was also quite shocked when Musk came out and said that, because I think you're right. I think he missed the point. It's not just about the actual text of it. It's about, okay, how does this fit into a broader agenda that the new administration has in the US? And that tends to be one that is highly kind of bigoted and racist and wants to kind of, through seemingly normal means or legal means, essentially go back to a kind of like almost 1950s sort of style of, you know, situation, doesn't it? So yeah, so it's a bit frustrating when Musk kind of jumps on board that train a bit, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And you mentioned the question of, you know, should he, can he work from the inside to maybe stop some of the worst excesses? And I know this is a debate. My personal take on it is that no, this will not work at all. Mm. Because the point with this advisory council is not to actually advise Trump. It's to make Trump look better. He can say, look, yep, I've got these cool technologists, these really clever people, these amazing entrepreneurs, and they're advising me. So you can be sure that even if you don't quite understand what I'm doing, it's ultimately, you know, the right thing. And then he doesn't actually have to listen to them. He's just co-opting them. Mm. And I feel like, given his pattern of also co-opting people of, for example, meeting with civil rights leaders, not to discuss anything with them, but just so he gets a headline saying that he's met with some civil rights leaders, to me that really suggests that the only thing you can do there is excuse yourself and, you know, not play his game. Because you're not going to be able to change anything. And Musk clearly feels differently.
So how did this scenario, how did the situation then inspire the game exactly? Like, what was your goal with the game? Obviously, you targeted at Musk specifically, right? So what was your actual goal with it?
Sure. So the idea there was to make a game that sort of takes his particular life dream of being able to go to Mars and mashing it up with the problems that are happening right now, mashing it up with the thing that he's just dismissed as not that bad. And so the scenario is that you are at a spaceport, there's a rocket to Mars, you've got all of your documents ready, you're going to board your Mars rocket and go away to space, but then it turns out that your documents aren't valid anymore because of some presidential order, and the whole thing turns into this sort of Kafkaesque scenario where you go back and forth trying to get the right forms from a bunch of unsympathetic bureaucrats, which is essentially what's happening. And so the idea was really just to sort of like, the reason I called it Martian Immigration Nightmare was that really my ideal goal would be for him to actually have this nightmare in his sleep, you know, to have that, just that scenario of like, he's almost there, but then at the last moment, he can't go to Mars because of this sort of thing.
I have to say, it really spoke to me because I'm an immigrant to the UK, so I'm from Australia originally, mm-hmm. and I've had to go through, well, not quite as nightmarish a situation as that, but I've certainly had to deal with my, you know, the UK bureaucracy in terms of like the border force and the border agency, and I have to get my passport photocopied every year to make sure that I'm still working at the same job, and there's loads and loads of bureaucratic just completely bizarre stuff. I now, like, immigrants in the UK are the only people that have to carry around biometric identification cards, whereas UK, I mean, this is fairly normal in other European countries. I lived in Belgium as well, but in the UK, it's kind of like it's a forbidden sort of topic. To, you know, the idea of ID cards is highly contentious and amongst the British public. So, but yet immigrants have to carry these things. So it's the idea of this kind of taking the dreamer, I suppose you could say, and putting them into this nightmare situation. You know, you dream about going to Mars or coming to the UK or going to America. As an immigrant or a traveler or a tourist or whatever, and then suddenly you're just faced with just ridiculous red tape that makes absolutely no sense half the time. I mean, that's a very real situation for me. I mean, not obviously as bad as the current the Muslim ban and things like that, but certainly I can definitely empathize with that whole situation. I think that's why it spoke to me so much. So yeah.
Yeah, and I think one of the things the game tries to do is that it's not just that you're being told, no, we hate you, you can't go into space, because that's not actually how these things work. And I think that's where this sort of misunderstanding, oh, this isn't so bad, comes from. It's not when these things happen, ultimately, when these sort of terrible things, even these atrocities happen, it's hardly ever one single policy. It's being boxed in by a number of different policies. It's being abandoned by people who don't care about you as a human being and just see you as a nuisance. So, you know, talking about the details of the game, you can try to call your lawyer in the game, but as it happens, there is actually no way of doing so. And this isn't some kind of clever design on part of the bad people to prevent you from doing that. It's just their utter apathy towards helping you with this. Okay, your mobile phone doesn't work. You need coins for the payphone. None of these, you know, guys behind the counters are going to give you coins because, hey, that's not their problem. And it's often this unwillingness to make connections, to realize that this isn't about coins, this is about your legal right to a lawyer. That's really where this sort of thing, where the combination of these sorts of policies and attitudes turns into something so much worse than what it might say on the piece of paper, what it might say in the policy itself.
And do you think that this lack of I'm going to call it lack of empathy, because I think that's what you often get in these bureaucratic situations. You get the person who's behind the counter, and they've been working all day dealing with a whole bunch of very upset and unhappy people, and they have to sort of, I guess, switch off a little bit. Did you think back to games a bit like Papers, Please, for example, for that? Because I see a lot of similarity in that style of the bureaucratic disconnect between the people and the bureaucracy. Obviously, at this time, you're on the other side of that, and you're trying to make your case known to that person. But it, you know, for them, it's just that, you know, they can't help you. That's not their job, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, I mean, Papers, Please was a big inspiration for this game, obviously, and I think it's a great game. What I think it does, what makes it atypical, what makes it perhaps incorrect, is that everything rests on the player. You are actually given too much power, in a sense. You're the sole person who gets to decide about these people. And so the responsibility, like these dilemmas it creates, like, do you let these people in? Do you, like, you know, there's one fairly early on where you have a woman and a man come in, and they're married, and one of them has a correct visa and the other one doesn't. Do you separate them? Do you let the other one in? What do? You create these sort of dilemmas. And that's great. You know, it's great gameplay that really drives home the point of these problems. But in reality, it's not a single person who makes these decisions. It's an apparatus You will get chanted over to that desk to do that form, to reapply to do this. And no one, you know, you are on purpose, of course, being given this responsibility, you are being given the choice. But the way that bureaucracies can commit these sort of inhumanities is exactly by dissipating responsibility for the people they process between multiple people, each of whom are just, you know, doing their job, processing the people. You know, they're not trying to be nasty, but the effect of it in total is horrible.
Yeah, and I think that also that lack of that empathy sort of comes out from the game as well. So as the player, I mean, obviously you were trying to put the player in the shoes of somebody who, you know, was trying to get into the US in this time. And so being able to kind of, I mean, there's that classic talk, that classic thing about walking a mile in another person's shoes, right? And so were you trying to bring back some of that empathy for the player as well, like Papers, Please does for the attendant at the booth?
Yes, absolutely. My real goal with making the game, honestly, wasn't to get Elon Musk to play it, because he probably is too important or thinks he's too important to do it, and he's probably too smart to comment on it if he did. So he may have played it, but I think he's too smart to comment. But the real point was to target people who were sort of aware of the situation, but could be made more aware of how much of a problem it is by playing this game. So I'm not targeting, you know, my target audience here isn't dyed-in-the-wool racists who actually think genocide is great. I'm not going to convince them there. The target audience is normal people who feel like this is a bit unfortunate, but they're not quite sure, and they've got other things on their mind, and to kind of try and give them more of an idea of what it actually feels like.
Okay, so what other games? I mean, obviously, that this yours is one of the, well, I wouldn't say one of the first that's come out necessarily, but it's certainly, I mean, it's one that's gone past my view more recently than. Like, I don't know, are you aware of any other games, basically, that tackle similar issues or, you know, tackle post-2016 politics and things like that?
I think it's just a little bit too early yet. I mean, I really rushed this thing out. I made it in 3 days because I wanted it to be still relevant when it was finished. So I would guess that given another few weeks or months, we will see a lot more. I mean, what's already out there, what, for example, what I saw at Global Game Jam, which I helped organize in Zurich, is that it sort of turned into a bit of an impromptu anti-Trump jam. We had, I think, 2 or 3 submissions that were about Donald Trump. But those tended to be, you know, more just sort of immediate visceral reactions. Like, I think the number of Global Game Jam games where you can kill Trump is probably measured in the triple digits. I don't know. I wouldn't be surprised. We had one of those.
We had
one which was satirical, and the other one was pretty much literally just about killing Donald Trump.
And how do you feel about that sort of a game? I mean, do you think there should be any limits to these sorts of to video games and that sort of thing?
Well, I think that particular game, I mean, was quite silly and obviously not very, you know, it wasn't very serious in a sense. I think because it was sort of a game where you had to move around some waves of stuff and to try and kind of get a bomb onto a boat that had like a Donald Trump kind of logo on it.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So that was fairly abstract. I definitely would take issue with something where you're just literally, I don't know, have Donald Trump's face and you shoot it or something.
There's another game where I put my Twitter call out for games that are political games. Somebody wrote back to me and said, well, I'm making a Punch Nazis game. And, I mean, I've since seen a screenshot of it. It's not quite as, you know, but it immediately brought me back to the you know, various punching high people in high high positions that games that came out a couple of years ago with the Gamergate stuff. And I was sort of, it made me start thinking about, okay, well, where's this line that we draw between, I mean, obviously punching Nazis. I mean, I've had a lot of interesting discussions with various people about whether it's ethically okay to punch Nazis. But if we just set that aside a little bit and we think about whether it's ethically okay to depict punching Nazis in video games, then you get back to things like, you know, Return to Castle Wolfenstein and all that, where you're actually shooting Nazis, right? I mean, literal Nazis. So, I mean, I guess, do you think that those sorts of questions will, do you think they'll challenge or in what way do you think they might challenge or restrict or get game developers thinking about what it is that they put into their games?
Yeah, totally. I think it's... I think there's a great deal of sort of asymmetry going on there. Obviously, there's. I think it also occurred to me there's a kind of a really awkward parallel in between. If you make a game where you like punch Nazis, it's, you know, and then there were these Gamergate games where you could like punch
Anita Sarkeesian.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I feel like you can make arguments that okay, it's not the same thing, you know. Are we punching Nazis in general? Are we punching her? Whatever, you know, you're not coming. The whole question of, you know, where they are sort of structurally and so on. But on the whole, I mean, at least the parallel is sort of a bit unnerving. And so I feel like if you need to make a game where you punch someone for your own sense of catharsis, then go ahead. I mean, whatever. I don't think it adds anything to anything in the sense of, you know, I feel like if you want to make that for yourself or for your friends or whatever, or just as a form of catharsis, then yeah, sure. But it's not adding anything to the discussion, which I guess it doesn't have to. Hmm. And I think the more we go to the point where you're talking about doing worse and worse harm to a more and more specific person, the less okay I am with that, not from a point of view that I maybe don't wish harm on those people, but just because I'm not very comfortable with the idea of, oh, let's just all make games about brutally murdering specific people.
Maybe it's got to do with the specificness of those people. So, I mean, in Wolfenstein and that, we kill generic anonymous Nazis and everybody knows that, you know, 1930s Nazis are bad, right? But these days, because we don't have that kind of temporal disconnect, and we also don't have necessarily, I guess, unless you live in kind of Germany and places that were within the occupation, but you may not necessarily have that personal interaction either. And so actually, I mean, I was having a discussion with a colleague of mine, and his grandfather was, well, he's German, and his grandfather was a Nazi, and he was quite uncomfortable with the discussion about talking about punching Nazis, and we talked a little bit about, okay, so how do you feel about these games that are, you know, old games like Wolfenstein and that, and he said, well, I don't really have so much of a problem with that because it's not now. You know, it takes that context of the time back then, and it has a sort of a temporal disconnect with now, whereas now, I mean, there's a difference between being able to act fictionally in the past versus being able to potentially act really, like realistically and real in real space as well now, if that makes sense. So,
yeah, and I think a really big question is how, to what degree do we admit to this sort of separation mattering? Like, should it matter that if we, you know, if I make a game about, I don't know, shooting Donald Trump, okay, that's one thing. Now, if I just rename him slightly, you know, if it's Ronald Flump or whatever, is that better? I mean, everyone still knows what I'm talking about. You know, if I just make Corrupt Politician Shooting Simulator 2017, still everyone knows what I'm talking about. Mm. And on the other hand, you know, you get this sort of, is because then we're really talking about also sort of dehumanization, where you get stuff like, oh, let's do a military shooter where you're just shooting people generically named as terrorists who run around against backgrounds with badly written Arabic or something. And it's like, you know, why is this now actually better?
Yeah.
So I think that's pretty hard.
It's a difficult discussion. I mean, I don't think I've got any easy answers either, to be honest with you. And but I think what's important is actually getting people to think about this and being a bit uncomfortable. And I mean, certainly for me, I found that whole discussion with my colleague very interesting to kind of unpick what it was that was actually making me feel so uncomfortable about it. And I still haven't quite worked out what that is. But I mean, I think that, I mean, personally, I think that games have got a lot to add in this sort of in this area in terms of making people feel uncomfortable. And I think yours does it to a certain, you know, a degree, in that it makes people realize a bunch of things they probably didn't think about before, especially if they're in a position where they've never had to deal with this sort of bureaucracy before. And so it can make people a bit uncomfortable in that regard, because they think, oh, actually, yeah, that's really awful. And now, but then now what can I do about it? And that, I think, is, I mean, how do you feel that these sorts of games then fit into this broader context of actual activism in terms of, you know, anti-Trump activism or anti-Nazi or whatever it is that you want to phrase it?
I think one of the, well, the great thing about games can be that because they are interactive, they can bring you closer to something. That's what this game was trying to do, is because you're actually sort of playing through this frustrating experience, I hope it brings it closer to you than just watching a film or reading about it, because it puts you more directly into the shoes, as you said. So I think equally you can have, so I think there's a lot of value in games for actually describing systems rather than just facts. Because if you just have, oh, here's a bunch of individual factoids, and that doesn't necessarily really tell you what's going on. And by making a game that actually shows you what the resulting system is, that can explain a lot better what's going on. If you make, you know, if you want to describe why something is going wrong in the world, why perhaps people are acting badly, or why there are perverse incentives, well, you can create a game which gives players these perverse incentives. Like, for example, Papers, Please, which get people to have a better understanding of, for example, why, you know, simple solutions don't necessarily work. Mm. Why don't they just do X? And the answer is, well, they can't just do X because there's this whole interrelated set of systems and incentives and people who are trying to do things. And X doesn't actually fix any of this, or will just make it worse.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I think it's just, I really like this sort of discussion about, especially because I think a lot of people feel a bit helpless at the moment. They're not quite sure what they're supposed to necessarily do. I mean, you know, they can call their Congress people or whatever, but I mean, also, I mean, I assume that you're not American. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm actually Swiss. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I'm not American either, but I can, I think that it's also good for Americans to realize how much this can potentially affect other people that aren't Americans as well. So, I mean, the fact that there's a lot of movement coming out of Europe. I mean, you've seen the all the late night show movies about the, you know, America first, Germany or Switzerland or whoever else second, Netherlands
yes.
second. Yeah. So I think that there's, it seems to me that there's a really nice kind of galvanizing of, well, I guess it's almost, I wouldn't quite say it's kind of anti-fascist, because they're not quite, I mean, they're getting there, but they're not quite there yet. But it's sort of this anti, you know, extreme right wing, bigoted kind of potential people in power. I mean, you've got it across Europe as well, don't you? And I mean, the Austrians saw off their one relatively recently, but we've got Le Pen, and we've obviously got Brexit in the UK, which has just been a complete disaster. I'd love to see a game that explores all the problems with Brexit, but hey, it's probably a bit late for that now. I think that, you know, what's nice is that with games, I think we can go it from, it's not just about little siloed communities. It's something that people from all around the world can kind of appreciate. But also it can get different perspectives. So a European perspective on American issues is going to be very, quite different from an American perspective on American issues. Do you see, work much with American kind of indie developers and see that sort of divide within game development at all? Because I certainly see it in terms of how you address things like ethics and responsibility in development and industry areas.
I honestly have mostly been out and about in Europe. So I've been to Germany quite a few times. I actually used to live in the UK as well. So I'm in contact with US developers on Twitter, basically. And I'm, you know, gaining also quite a lot of hope and inspiration on the things that they are doing there. I was really pleased, for example, that both the RDJ and GDC just came out straight against the whole thing and didn't, you know, sort of try to get away with not having to say anything. So I was definitely pleased with that. I'm actually positively surprised that that it's been sort of unanimous, or at least if it hasn't been unanimous, then I haven't noticed any voices saying, yeah, actually, Trump is great, we hate foreigners.
Do you think that's the nature of being an indie developer a bit, though? Like, I mean, if you're within, like, I mean, obviously, if you're building games and you're doing it kind of on the side or for fun, or, you know, like for minimal, you know, you're not in there with the, well, you're in there with the big guys, but it's not like you're doing your own thing, I suppose. Do you think that's more of a, I don't know, I think we're getting a bit off topic from the podcast now, but I think that, yeah, I mean, do you think there's a sort of a more liberal bent, I guess, on for indie developers? Or, you know, is there a sort of deep hidden underground of, like, weird alt-right game developers that we just haven't seen? I mean, I haven't seen anything much either, apart from those Gamergate ones, but...
Yeah, I think by and large they do skew pretty liberal and pretty left. I mean, ultimately, it's a creative type of job. You know, you might equally well say, well, you know, people who do art, who do music, whatever, also tend to skew in that direction. You can talk long for a long time about, you know, why exactly that is, but I don't think it's really surprising. And it is a very international community. Mm. So yeah, I mean, to indie developers, I think the whole thing just seems, you know, quite insane.
Yeah. Okay, so just to finish up, if you had a sort of a message to indie developers out there who were interested in kind of making political games or were mad about the current political system and wanted to do something about it, what would you tell them?
Oh, I would say, you know, absolutely go for it. You can, I know that there is a fear that if you expose yourself politically in public, then, you know, the Gamergate hate mob will come after you. I had that fear as well. I actually got in touch with Valve beforehand and said to them, so people might brigade my games on Steam and, like, mass downvote them, you know, which didn't happen. So yeah, but I think it is worth it, and I think it is worth standing up for it, and you can protect yourself. If you're worried about this, the obvious resource to go to is Crash Override, which is a great website. It will basically talk you through, you know, protecting yourself against this sort of hacking and doxing and so on. And then, yeah, think about what you want to express. And yeah, think about what you can make. What you can make that's really, you know, a game. What can you use the fact that it's a game for, the fact that it's interactive for, that's unusual, that you couldn't do with just making a comic or writing a blog post or something like that. I mean, if you want to do that, fine. But there's a lot of possibility there, I think, which we can explore.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me and to the lovely audience of my very occasional podcast.
Great, thank you.
You've been listening to the Not Just a Game podcast. The music in this podcast is Hot Machine Cold Surface by Ben Prunty on OC Remix. The graphics are from the Noun Project.